Run with David Fowler this morning, the Senior Vice President of Capital Markets at Associated Bank. David, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me. I always appreciate talking with you.
You are our go-to guy on Brexit-related news, and I want to start there this morning. Since the Brexit became official, we've seen a couple of different trade agreements being announced between the UK and other countries. The latest includes Norway and Iceland. Talk to us a little bit about the trade deals that the UK is putting together post-Brexit.
Well, yeah, as you say, they were able to sign a deal with Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein, who are three members of an association called the European Economic Area. These are countries that have a very close alignment to the EU, but are not members of the EU for various reasons. The deal that Britain has done with these three countries, to an extent, replicates the access that they had prior to Brexit, as part of the EU, although not as much. So in all cases, the access to markets they have is less than they had before, but still is, you know, something to help, certainly help trade for the UK. And also, I think it's particularly important for countries like Norway, where Britain was their largest trading partner for quite a long time.
Do these deals replace at all what's being lost with the EU, or are these mainly politically significant deals?
To an extent, I think it's more the latter than the former. So if you take, you know, Norway, Liechtenstein, and Iceland, that's a combined population of less than 7 million people. The European Union, without Britain, is about 300 million. Certainly, the amount of trade that Britain did with the European Union on an annual basis prior to Brexit was about kind of £350 billion. This is worth maybe $2-3 billion. So we're looking at significantly smaller numbers. But from a political point of view, you know, it shows that they are able to negotiate some trade deals. They've done one with Japan, I believe. They may have one with Singapore as well. There are some issues with one with Australia. But, you know, they are trying to move ahead with this, you know, showing that they are an independent country, that they are going to forge trade alliances around the world. But they've yet to do one that, you know, with any country or any economic area that is anywhere close in size to the European Union.
There had been some talk that maybe a deal on some issues was being worked out with the United States. Is that even still on the radar, or is that something that's in the wings waiting?
If there is one, it's not going to be anytime soon. So I think that's going to be at least a year, maybe 18 months down the road. It's not a high priority for the U.S., from what it seems. Certainly, as we all know, President Biden is going to the G7 meeting in Britain this week, and there will be meetings on Brexit and the impact of Brexit, Northern Ireland, and the Good Friday Agreement. Certainly, Britain would like to have a trade deal with the U.S. because that would replicate the market size that they've given away with the European Union, and would give them a real big political win as well as an economic one. But I think that's not close yet.
How are things going inside of the UK? I know the last time we talked, some especially small businesses in the UK were still struggling post-Brexit. Is that still the case, or have things improved?
It's still the case. And I think part of it is, you know, the agreement is less than six months old. So, you know, there is a certain amount of kind of teething that we have to go through. And as time goes on, exporters and importers both will, you know what documents they need, know how those documents need to be framed. And that kind of operational aspect will get smoother. But there are certain aspects that you still can't get around. So if you're in the agri side and you're exporting any kind of food product from the UK into the EU, you have to go through a lot of hurdles. You know, there's we've talked about them in the past. There are phytosanitary, there's veterinary certificates that are, you know, very expensive unless you're exporting in bulk. And, you know, what we're seeing is a lot of UK companies that had a significant proportion of the sales into the European Union, are looking to find a way to locate in the European Union in order to be able to access the market without having to go through so many hurdles.
There, I know we talked about all the paperwork and some of the roadblocks that some of these businesses were facing. Has there been any movement to try to lessen some of that, or is that going to take even more time to iron out?
Well, I think the part of the problem is that and this is where the kind of political side goes into the economic side. The UK is, you know, adamant about trying to minimize the impact of Brexit on both its importers and exporters. And they've adopted an approach of kind of unilateralism. So they've just said, you know, we're not going to implement certain checks, certain activities that they've agreed to in international law to do. This approach doesn't really help in the long run, because what it does lead to in the short term is a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, before the call, I was kind of thinking about this. And, you know, I used to be the treasurer of a public company, and we operated a lot overseas. And when we would make investments, you know, one of the things that we wanted to look at was the certainty of the regulatory environment that we're going to operate in. So, you know, we may not like the regulations, but we wanted them to be certain, so that we could plan around them and then say, okay, if we do X, Y, and Z, then, you know, we can operate in this market and it's going to be economically viable. You know, people now have no idea what's going to happen, because, you know, one minute they have to abide by these regulations. The next minute, maybe they don't. But they know that, you know, there's going to be, if the UK continues to operate in this kind of unilateral approach, the EU is going to slap on duties, and not necessarily in the same sector that the, you know, this kind of ad hoc one-sided, you know, we don't care about the regulation side impacts. So, you know, they might do something on the veterinary side or the food side to make things easier, but the EU may slap tariffs on the manufacturing side. So you have this kind of, you just don't know where you're going. And I think of everything that's causing a problem for business, that's the problem. This lack of certainty. And it seems to be only getting worse rather than better.
The UK is trying to throw a little money at this. I know they've launched a multi-million dollar fund to help support some of these businesses that are struggling. Is money going to be enough to sort of soothe some of these pains?
Well, money always helps. That's always for sure. But I don't think it's enough. I think this is more fundamental than that. And I think really what Britain needs to kind of decide, and I think they're, you know, kind of in the process of working this through, they need to decide what they want to do, what they want to be, and where they want to do it. And, you know, as we talked about before, they're kind of in this kind of swipe left, swipe right situation, where, you know, if they try to focus on the EU market and kind of replicate what they had before they left the EU, you know, the voters are going to ask, why do we ever leave? Right? So politically, it's a disaster. But they have been unable to, so far, to sign the kind of economic agreements, you know, with the rest of the world that replicate anything like they've given away. And I think that's going to be the problem. So fundamentally, until they really find what they want to be and how they're going to do it, you know, a little bit of money here and there just to kind of ease over the costs of red tape, I don't think it's going to cut it in the long term.
David, the COVID situation has impacted hospitality in this country, the hospitality industry in this country. In the UK, you've had Brexit in on that, and it's really become a crisis. People can't find staffing. There are some other issues involved, and that's sort of at the foundation of the economy in the UK like it is here, right?
Absolutely. You know, in a lot of the hospitality type jobs, people would be, you know, somewhat kind of temporary workers. So you would have people that would migrate from particularly the eastern parts of the European Union to, you know, England, to the UK, to Ireland, to France and Germany, and work during the summer, during that kind of summer surge. And between COVID, you know, closing borders and the fact that European Union workers no longer can move freely into the UK is now finding that they have a shortage of of staff. And what's kind of ironic in one respect was that a gentleman called Tim Martin, who is the CEO of a company called Wetherspoons, that own a number of different bar chains and restaurant chains in the UK, is now calling for a, you know, EU worker entry scheme when he was one of the main proponents of Brexit in the first place. So I think, you know, a lot of the kind of leaving the EU for the UK was kind of political, aspirational. We want to be, you know, basically the UK that we were 100 years ago. And I think now what we're seeing is, what they're seeing is that there are economic consequences, and things really weren't planned out very well. And the warnings that were given 3 years, 4 years, 5 years ago, that, you know, there would be staff shortages. How are you going to deal with EU residents who've been working and living in the UK for 20, 30, 40 years? How are they going to be dealt with? And it was all this kind of, we'll deal with it when we deal with it. And I think now those chickens are somewhat coming home to roost.
A lot of folks are looking at Boris Johnson for some leadership on this issue, and he's going to be meeting for the first time, I think, with President Biden. Talk to us a little bit about what his leadership will mean to whether or not this fails or succeeds.
Well, I think with Boris Johnson, it's kind of important to remember that one of his goals is to be the longest serving prime minister in the UK. So right now, Tony Blair holds that position. Boris Johnson would like to be that. But he also doesn't want to be the one guy, the one prime minister who was there and saw the kind of dissolution of the union of Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. And so he's got to try to find a way to keep everything intact for as long as it's necessary to get to that, you know, magic date. Certainly, the Northern Ireland protocol is very important in terms of peace within the island of Ireland and, you know, the Good Friday Agreement. President Biden has said, his representatives have said, that this is something of great importance to the United States, the U.S. administration. Boris Johnson does not have a good record in terms of credibility with the Northern Ireland Protocol. And the trouble is, or the trouble that you can face, is that if people don't believe you on one thing, they don't believe you on anything. And if you get a reputation for not living up to international treaties, which the UK is, this is the reputation the UK is getting under the Johnson government, that's going to be a problem. And that's one of the reasons why, as I said earlier, you know, the U.S. is kind of waiting and seeing in terms of putting together a trade deal with Britain, because I think they want to use the leverage that they have in order to kind of smooth things over in the Northern Ireland Protocol. But also, I think they want to see how Britain behaves as an independent nation. And that's a terrible thing to have to say, because for, you know, hundreds of years, you know, Britain at least lived up to its international agreements. So I think we have to wait and see. Certainly there is more, it's a trade deal between the UK and the US is more important for the UK than it is for the US. And that does give the US administration here a certain amount of leverage.
David, great conversation as always. How can people get a hold of you and have a one-on-one if they want?
Well, you can always call me on the desk, which is 866-524-8836. Or you can always send me an email, and my email address is david.faller, F-A-L-L-E-R, @associatedbank.com.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Steve.